favorable for people to invest in solar. Volume is going to help us drive that cost down. Turnover, the ability to just install very quickly. If you're in Australia, big part of the reason why it's so inexpensive for you is because you can decide on Monday that you want to put solar on, and on Friday, you're hooking your solar up. If you do that in this country, it's Monday in 1 month, and it's a Friday in several months down the road that you might turn your solar on. That kind of delay, that kind of complication, and the review processes and all of that add to the difficulty in customer acquisition, in installation, well, permitting, and then installation, and then eventually powering up the system. So there are many ways that we can drive costs out, and we're all responsible for some piece of it. Government, advocacy groups, industry, banks and finance. We all have a role to play in helping drive that cost down.
People can learn more about what Sach does at Vote Solar by going to votesolar.org. He's the executive director of Vote Solar, Sach Constantine. Sach, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Martin Medeski and Wood and Ziggy Marley. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
You know, on a really dark night, even in the North Carolina mountains, you might be able to pick up KBOO, community radio, coming to you from Portland, Oregon. This is SciCon coming to you from Charlotte, North Carolina, supporting community radio, radio that works for all of us.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Andy, moan, my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Mike Rosen. He's the board chair for the Northwest Museum of Cartoon Arts, which is open at 322 Northwest 8th Avenue in the Pearl. Mike is talking about The Spirit of Will Eisner, a retrospective, and this is a new show that runs through June 15th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus for the first time, Mike.
Oh, thank you. We really appreciate getting some attention.
Yeah, so if you didn't know it, listeners, a Museum of Cartoon Arts, or comics as some people call them, open in the Pearl. It's a massive space, really beautiful and modern. And when did it open, Mike?
We had a soft opening in November, only open a few days to work out bugs, and our official opening was December 3rd.
And you had a sort of multi-artist show first?
Yeah, our first show was a retrospective on creators from the Pacific Northwest. So mostly Portland. There's a ton of creators in Portland. So we showed artists, writers, featured their work in the museum. Some of the greatest artists and creators from the last 50 years and some of the newer creators that are in Portland. Mm-hmm.
You sort of imported the next show, which is the one that we're talking about today, called The Spirit of Will Eisner, a Retrospective. Where did it come from?
Came from the Billy Ireland Library and Cartoon Art Museum, and it's located at Ohio State University. And they have the biggest collection of cartoon arts in the world. It's an incredible repository. I just want to thank Dark Horse Comics, who sponsored this exhibit and allowed us help finance bringing it to Portland.
Tell us who Will Eisner was. And I will tell the listeners, when you come in, there are many dozen Will Eisner pieces on the walls. They're prints of originals, so they look like originals. And the walls are kind of low, so even though you see multiple rooms, you're never kind of boxed in. You can see across the room And there's a lot to see.
Will Eisner, you should really care about him if you're interested in comics, because he was basically one of the founders, one of the greats. He was born in 1917, and he really blossomed in his late teens and early 20s. He had his own studio. He lived till he was 88, and he was working on and just finished his last graphic novel at 88, and then sadly he passed away, and a lot of his work towards the end of his life was published by our own Dark Horse Comics in Milwaukee. One of the reasons why he's so famous is in his studio, he hired some famous artists like Wally Wood and Jack Kirby to work for him. He started doing strip comics that were in newspapers, but he was a real proponent of writing a single story about a single character. And his seminal character, his most famous character, was the Spirit. Late into his career, he was a proponent of the graphic novel. He coined the phrase graphic novel as he was trying to get his first book, graphic novel, published, A Contract with God. So if you want to see the history of comics, from the very start, comics inserts into newspapers, to comic books, to graphic novels, this is the place to be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you're just like, how do we get from like a yellowy old newsprint to these 723 episodes of Japanese, you know, cartoons on TV and online? This is a great place to start, because this is the kind of yellowing old newsprint era. I mean, you said he just came out of high school loving it and set up his own studio, so he was an entrepreneur.
In the late 20s, early 30s, he had the idea of developing his own. I mean, comic strips were popular. They were in newspapers, and comic books in their infancy was a compilation of comic strips into a booklet form. But then superheroes started to be created, and it was kind of a new thing to have a booklet that was a full story of a character. And he started out doing odd graphic design jobs, but he quickly graduated into the idea of comic strips and then comic books. Mm-hmm.
So let's look at, as you come in the door, turn to the left, under the kind of banner about Will Eisner, you've got these five pieces, and like I said, these are reproductions, so they look very real. You know, there's white out, the paper is yellow, the black ink is sort of unfinished in places. And it's about this character, the Spirit. So he's not a superhero, right? He's a detective.
He's a detective
with a past.
He's a detective. He fakes his own death so he can more effectively fight crime. He works with the police chief. He has no superpowers. He wears a blue suit, a red tie, a blue fedora, and a blue mask. And he gets into all sorts of trouble. He has quite a few enemies through his career. The publishing started in the early 40s and has run all the way through the 70s. Different creators have picked up the character. It's so popular, and have created their own stories over the years. He really set the tone for early comics. He, as I said, he was an innovator. He didn't just draw a comic book with a fixed number of panels on a page. He was very artistic in his layouts and his use of shading and setting a mood. It was very noirish and very popular. He probably worked on the Spirit for about 5 years, then he was drafted and into World War II. And actually, he found a career in World War II in comics, doing education work about maintenance of equipment.
Yeah, so the first five pieces, you can see how he used a standard grid of 3x4 squares. Each panel's a square. Occasionally, in another one, he'd make a rectangle out of two of them. So it looked kind of very ordinary. And then you see the kind of the cover pages. So he would. You said he would always take the words "the Spirit." Is this the splash page?
Yeah, the cover page could be considered the splash page. He also had splash pages in his comics where it was just one big panel. Uh-huh. But in the cover, he incorporated the words, the Spirit, in very creative ways. Mm-hmm. into the cover. It was almost a part of the story, the way it was presented.
So in one of them, the haunted house, it's, you know, a creaky old door with cobwebs opening, and the spirit is kind of chiseled into the wood. The light is coming through. And then there's another one where he's like, the spirit is spanking his girlfriend, who's the daughter of the police chief, I understand. He's got kisses, lipstick kisses on his face. He's got her over his knee. And,
It isn't a modern image of portrayal of a woman.
he'd have got cancelled right away today. But everywhere you look, the spirit is always a kind of brand. You know, he messes with the font or the way he presents the name of the comic.
Yeah, he was really innovative in his panel framing and the way he did layouts, the way he used ink to create shadows. And he was really influenced by noir cinema, and you can see that come through in the comics.
Mm-hmm. And then you said when in the war, he worked for the government, and he was doing like these funny little brown and pink and black and white cartoons of soldiers. There's one. His character was Joe Dope.
Right.
Joe Dope, like a kind of a dumb soldier.
Right.
And in one, he's on a beach, and he's looking at his service revolver, and it's got rusty. He's thinking of killing these two pigs that are wild pigs,
right,
and cooking them, but they're not bothered. They're just lying back laughing because they know his gun is rusty and won't work.
Right, won't work.
Another one, a sergeant is grabbing Joe Dope because his machine gun is all bent and burnt out, and it looks like it shot the sergeant in the butt because
right.
his pants are all torn off. So this was just sort of government propaganda for soldiers. And,
yeah.
I mean, not really propaganda, but instructional manuals.
Yeah, he graduated to doing instructional manuals. He started in World War II, but he was contracted by the armed forces throughout the decades to continue to do that kind of work. It was so popular.
Mm-hmm.
All the way into the Vietnam War, he did instructional manuals for the soldiers.
And then you have another section of the spirit from the late 40s. What did we learn about his progress? You say he kind of messed around with layout and, you know, the sort of dramatic use of darkness and shade.
Right, and he also incorporates humor into his comics, and we have a series that, I don't know, this dates me. I don't know if 17-year-olds will know this. But there were some very famous comic strips, Little Abner. They'll probably know Little Orphan Annie and even Dick Tracy because mm-hmm. they made movies out of them. And he's parodying them.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't without a sense of humor, even though it was noir.
And he wrote all this. I mean, he was the writer and the drawer.
And the artist.
Yeah. We're still in the entrance to the museum. There's a low purple wall. So if you go and look at it, you'll see a section where there's a artist writing by candlelight. And he's penniless because he's saying, Will Eisner's parodied my star creations and I can't make any money. So there's a sort of meta element to this.
Yeah, the characters kind of break the wall between the cartoon and the reader.
He's like in the world of comics completely. He's ready to satirize or parody or refer to, you know, other comics.
And this wasn't a traditional approach in the 40s and the 50s, and that's why he's considered an innovator. He created these tools that were picked up by others in the comic world, and so he was way ahead of his time. And because he owned the rights to the spirit, and he basically sold it to different newspaper publications, he had complete control of the character. He didn't have to work with an editor who said, you can't do that.
He had the money coming in and the artistic control.
Right, exactly. Comic creators owning the rights to their characters didn't happen until the late 80s, which was something that Dark Horse kind of pioneered for comics.
Hmm. Our own Dark Horse.
You're right. Yeah, that's how we got so many creators in the Portland area, because they were attracted. Dark Horse recruited them and gave them the full rights to their own character. So if they made a movie or a TV show, they completely profited and had control over the work.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Mike Rosen. He's the board chair for the Northwest Museum of Cartoon Arts, which opened last December. It's at 322 Northwest 8th Avenue. And he's talking about The Spirit of Will Eisner, a retrospective, which is on now through June 15th, 2026.
So one of his more popular stories, and it's considered a personal favorite of Will Eisner, is the story of Gerhard Schnabel. It's a story about a man who's determined to show the world that he can fly, but not to spoil it, it has a very sad end.
he's a normal little guy in a suit, you know, a typical zoot suit with a bowler hat, and I guess kind of a New York-y kind of guy.
Yeah, and He does attempt to fly and show the world he can, but it doesn't end well.
And the main page,
it
says, "This is not a funny story."
That's correct. So it opens with a warning about what you're about to see. So this is more work that we're showing of Eisner and the Spirit in the mid to late 40s, and you can start to see how he's breaking out of the traditional format of, you know, two or three panels and in three rows across a single page.
Yeah. So the panel's called The Slippery Eel, aka River of Crime, and it's just such good drawing. The people running around on fire, jumping over walls, tackling each other, you know, the incredible animation, you know, people, you could see the impact of a guy's head falling on the ground. It's just dramatic.
Yeah, and that's a really good point that you make. It's really kinetic. You can really see movement in the panels, and you can, like you said, it's almost like it is visual animation of the action.
So he was early in that kind of work.
Yeah. This one's really innovative and almost radical because the story, in part, is told through the criminal's eyes. So you're, like, looking at the story as if you're seeing it through the eyes of the criminal.
And it's called QWERTY? QWERT?
Yeah, the Spirit Quirt.
Yeah, so you've got seven panels framed. There are, like, eye holes where you're seeing. Right. There's a big page of white and then these eye holes. Footsteps in the sand, and then three panels of a guy sort of crawling in the desert.
Yeah, and we're able to show in the seven panels the full story.
And that was still the 1940s.
Yeah, now we're moving into the 50s, and you can see more of his imagination at play in some of these panels. I mean, I'm overusing the word innovative, but a very unique way of presenting the information and the story that he wants to present.
So this is the island, and the top right panel, you know, he's got this word heat and this sort of perspiration coming down to an eyeball. There's a man in a jungle surrounded by mosquitoes and flies that are huge. There's a close-up of a stubbly face with their eyes shaded out. Just a lot going on, and just a lot of work into panel.
Really
these, each one is like an intricate portrait of something.
Right. And when you think about it and you look at it, it's an incredible amount of work that goes into the drawing. Mm-hmm. They are not simple drawings within the panels, within the pages, and even the splash pages are really intricate.
Mm-hmm. He did one about a New York mayoral election in 1966. About John Lindsay, and there's a man coming out of, I guess it, I don't know what it is, but the word spirit, but the building is like made up of the word spirit, but it has panels in it. I guess if you saw that in your Sunday paper, you'd be kind of shocked.
Yeah, I think that's why people love the Spirit so much. They were surprised by every story in terms of the actual story and the way it was presented. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he did that in the little Abner Dick Tracy story. He breaks out of the panel and is kind of talking to the reader and talking to the writer.
Mm-hmm. And he could do that, right? Because he owned the intellectual property and the means of production and everything.
Right, he was his own editor, so he had full control. This one we have is several pages or three pages from a story called A Small Business. And what's cool about this is we have the really rough pencil drawings of the first three pages. And you can see Blue Line, which was originally in the 70s, you could start drawing in this blue pencil, and when you copied it, the blue disappeared and only the pencil would show. So it allowed you to decide where you wanted to put the pencil on a rough blue line, but then you didn't have to worry about erasing the blue line.
Oh, I see.
So you can see the first three panels, and then we move into the panels as they were inked, and you can see some of the difference between on the roughs and the
final. Oh, I see. So it's a kind of compare and contrast.
Yes.
Without the blue, what did they settle on?
Yeah. Right, exactly.
And just to explain, you know, comics, cartoons are always seem to be done in a studio. So one person kind of farms out the work to younger writers. People do coloring, all that stuff.
Right.
And he did that.
Right. He had in his studio, he had writers, pencilers, inkers, letterers, and colorists, and they all produced the final product.
Was it kind of like a writer's room? Did they have input, or was he just kind of dictatorial?
I think at some early on, he sat in the room and did some of, well, he did the writing and some of the drawing. And then later on, they operated independently, and they had a manager, which was a woman, which was quite unheard of in the 30s and early 40s. She was a writer, and she graduated to being one of the directors of his studio. Let's see, Tony Blum. It's funny because when she was hired, he assumed, because the name was Tony, that it was a man. And when he first met her, he was kind of surprised. But, he was fine with it. Mm-hmm. And that's another innovation, I guess, to have to start out in the 30s and 40s and have a woman as a key part of your mm-hmm. staff.
So he also considered himself a kind of an artist. And he wanted to write a kind of masterpiece or a big, serious book, like a graphic novel, and he wrote A Contract with God, another tenement story. So it's about life in New York tenements, about slumlords, that kind of thing. But it was inspired by what?
Well, it was inspired by, sadly, the death of his daughter at a really young age. She died of leukemia. A lot of his work, graphic novel work, was centered around life in New York and stories about being Jewish and living in New York in the 40s and 50s. And so The Contract with God was his first long-form comic, and he went to several book editors and tried to pitch it, and they always asked, well, what is it? We don't know what this is. And he finally said, well, it's a graphic novel. And that term caught on. So after Contract with God, he wrote created 20 more graphic novels. Mm. So he was quite prolific. Mm-hmm. And this first one was in 1978. So from the late 70s to the early 2000s, he created 20 books.
Wow. And presumably they sold, right? They weren't just vanity projects.
No, they weren't vanity projects. He became a really popular graphic novelist. And I'm so popular that the Academy Awards of Comics is called the Eisner Awards. So every year at the San Diego Comic Convention, the biggest in the world, they select from comics artists, cover artists, writers, letterers, graphic novelists. They select the best of the best. Mm-hmm. And it's the Eisner Award. Well, this is part of one of the graphic novel, and we have a few pieces, as I've said, in the show that show the process. And this one,
To the Heart of the Storm.
The Heart of the Storm, which is also a series of stories about growing up in New York. But this one shows the really rough pencils. And then later in the exhibit, you can see the final version of this.
Yeah. So these really are rough. I mean, these are like sketches. So in the back of the museum, there's a small gallery. If you came to the first show, this was the Joe Sacco room. And now this has got more Eisner. And here you get to the kind of peak of his, you know, this is the 80s, and he's just doing whatever he wants. I mean, crazy layouts. There are color pieces in here, you know, like exploding stars. It's just amazing.
Yeah, in the 80s, he was really prolific, and he branched out into science fiction work. more stories from New York.
There's a cover for a contract with God and other tenement stories. It's a man in a raincoat, totally soaked, and a hat, climbing a tenement staircase from the street up to the building. And the man's all in yellow as the streetlight is. And then there's a green staircase and then the purple shaded buildings and then the rain just pelting down.
Yeah, and that was that's watercolor that Eisner did for a later edition of The Contract with God. That's mm-hmm. the cover. You can see a splash page here of the tenement. You can see another graphic novel, Life Force, about a man who's dying. This quote...
read it out.
Yeah, it's really prescient. When he was 24, this was a quote from the Philadelphia Record in 1941, "The comic strip is no longer a comic strip, but, in reality, an illustrated novel. It is new and raw in form just now, but material for limitless intelligent development, and eventually and inevitably it will be a legitimate medium for the best of writers and artists." And that's another reason to come down to the exhibit, because you can see that transition of his art into what's considered today a legitimate art form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just the way the graphic novel gives such scope to the imagination, changing perspective on things while also having words. He kind of conceptualize that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was way ahead of his time.
So, Mike, you also have this kind of glassed-in room called the Art Studio where people can go in and draw. What are some of the benefits of being a member of this place?
Well, membership, it's $10 admission for adults, but membership is $40, and with your $40 membership, you get access to the museum for free, plus one 10% discount in our gift shop, and invitations to exclusive events.
Mm-hmm. It's $40 per year.
Yeah.
And then, so you do have a little merch front of house. Who do you hope to attract to the space?
We've said it's all ages and all walks of life, and the goal is for people to see and appreciate cartoon arts and comics as an art form and really understand the evolution of the product in the process. And we're standing in the writer's room, and we're really proud of this room. This is a room where you can look at the comic and the script that went along with it, and you can see the magic of how a comic script, which is like a screenplay, evolves into the art page and the actual final page of the work.
Mm-hmm. So it's an area with like two couches and a couple of bookshelves, and you take a ring binder and that shows you both the words and the final drawings.
Yeah, and people come in here, they pull a binder off the shelf, they hang out, and they get to pull out the comic and look at the script at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Is the comic or cartoon scene in Portland what it was 20 years ago?
It's 2026. I mean, the comic scene in Portland's been around for like 35 years. Mm-hmm. It's grown. It started with Dark Horse Comics, and Dark Horse Comics brought creators into Portland. They drafted them, and one of the big enticements was creators could own the rights to their work. So if they made a movie out of it, a TV show, whatever, all subsequent publications, all the rights were controlled by the creators, and they controlled all, they received all the profits from that work, and that attracted more creators. And we have an extraordinarily large comics community, writers, mm-hmm. colorists, letterers, inkers, you name it, the whole plethora of what it takes to create a comic or cartoon work.
So I think of like Craig Thompson, Blankets, and Joe Sacco, you know, Palestine.
Right.
And I think of Steve Lieber, and what's it called now?
Helioscope Studios, but it's the largest comic studio in the country.
That's incredible.
And it's over 20 artists and creators that work together in a big open space. They collaborate, mm-hmm. They comment on each other's work.
Yeah, yeah. Has the fact that you could do comics anywhere now on an iPad, you know, in Sumatra or somewhere, and send it instantly to your editor, has that changed the way people do it, or do they still prefer to meet together in rainy old Portland?
I think that's true. There's a lot of work that's exchanged over internet and over Zoom now, but there's still creators that, like, we have creators in Portland, we have writers and artists that work together, not in the same space, but they're located in the same city. But yeah, you can do that now. There's an incredible amount of work where you have the writer in England, or the artist in England and the writer in Portland. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the collaborations occur all over the world.
But you think maybe this space will give people somewhere to congregate occasionally?
Yeah, we have been done a lot on the weekends. We've brought in writers and artists to give talks, and we plan to continue that. And we'll do some classes for adults and children on comics creation. Mm-hmm. We really want to be a vibrant living space. That's why we've got the art room. We want people to come in and hang out. Mm-hmm. And learn about cartoon arts.
Yeah, and it's at 322 Northwest 8th, which is near the Jewish Museum, and the website is nwmoca.org, so check it out. My name's Joseph Galvin. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Mike Rosen. He's the board chair for the Northwest Museum of Cartoon Arts. And he was talking about The Spirit of Will Eisner, a retrospective, which is on now through June 15th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus.
Thank you. We really appreciate having you here, and it was a great pleasure.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, and him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Está escuchando KBOO Portland. Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 10 de marzo del 2026. Estados Unidos.